Alex spoke Russian, lived in Russia for a year, worked with Russian refugees in Chicago for 2 years. And his Russian teacher thought that he only needed one thing to make his life complete.
She thought I needed a Russian girlfriend. She thought that only Russians would be able to stand up to me the way that I needed to be stood up to, or something. I don't know.
Our American women are just too soft.
I don't know what she... I truly don't know. But anyway, that's the thought she had.
So she kept trying to fix him up with Russian women. And this one night she had him come out with a whole bunch of people, including this woman, Elena, who was going to be his date.
And so I meet them for dinner, and we're at the sushi restaurant, and we're all eating, and everybody's telling stories and funny stories, and I'm sitting across from my date, and my Russian teacher is turning to me and saying, you know, tell them this story, tell them that story. And so then I tell them this story and that story, and everybody's laughing except for my date. And so we leave the sushi restaurant, and we go to this club, and we're all dancing, like my Russian teacher's dancing, and all of her friends are dancing, and everybody's sort of like, you know, exchanging partners, and it's this sort of this fun scene, and everybody's dancing except for my date, who's just sitting at the table and sort of nursing a drink.
And looking
bored, really bored.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I keep on coming back from the dance floor and trying to, you know, saying, are you sure you want to dance? Do you want to dance? And then she sort of like, you know, will sort of smile bitterly and just shake her head. And so then somebody else will drag me out. And so finally I come back and I sit down and, you know, I'm sitting next to her and I'm trying to strike up a conversation. And, you know, something about, like, oh, yeah, I guess you don't like dancing or something like that. And she, like, sort of looks out at the floor, and there's, like, people having, you know, a great time all around. And she sort of, like, nods her chin towards the floor, and she's like, this is an American dance, no? And I drove away thinking, well, that was a horrible date. Like, neither of us enjoyed each other, and that was...
That was a disaster, yeah. Pretty much.
Like, we were not going to be seeing each other again. I get to Russian class the next week, and my Russian teacher says, hey, so are you going to call Elena? She said she had a great time. And I was floored by that. I was thinking, like, I was trying to figure out, like, what that could possibly have meant. Like, and so I was, like, sort of mulling it over in my head because it was really fascinating to me. And I realized that I have a very sort of, like, clear and perhaps culturally informed idea of what a great date is. And it has to do with the idea of, like, what it means to fall in love. And I realized that in my head, what I think about is a great date is what sort of you see in the movies, like sort of the falling in love montage of the movies. You know, you go on a great date, it often involves a boardwalk. There's a great deal of sort of like throwing your heads back in laughter. Right. You might chase each other around a tree.
There's the splashing of water.
Splashing of water is almost always involved. And I think for her, and this was something that I always noticed when I was in Russia, is that there's like, and I think that for her, it's a totally different thing. You know, in Russia, and in Russian literature, there's a lot of talk about the soul and soulmates, and like, I think for her, like, falling in love means finding the one person on the planet who understands the misery of life as deeply and fully as you do, and then can talk to you about it.
And so, when she acted all depressed on their date, she was not actually blowing Alex off, like he thought at the time. She was flirting. So Alex decides to ask his Russian teacher about this theory, that Americans and Russians have completely different views of what it means to fall in love. And I have to say he's a little bit nervous to try this out on her, because he's worried that maybe it's insulting or stereotyping Russians. But he explains the theory to her.
And she totally agreed. She was like, oh, yeah, that's absolutely right. You're right. And then she just went on a rant about Americans. And she was like, what? Americans, they have no understanding what it's like to fall in love. And like, in Americans, I never understand. Why do you always say, he makes me laugh? Why is that so important? He makes me laugh. Every American I've ever met, all they say when, you know, you ask them how the relationship is, and they say, he makes me laugh, as if that's the greatest thing in the world. What's so great about it? He makes me laugh. She just, you know, went off. Unlike something that I have, like, actually said many times, like, I just want somebody who makes me laugh.
Some days, it seems like every story in the world is a story of cultural misunderstanding between people of different countries, Muslims and Christians, blacks and whites, Republicans and Democrats, men and women, Spanish speakers and Anglos, adults and children, rich people and poor people. And so today, in this era of misunderstandings abroad and at home, we bring you an hour of stories about what gets lost in translation. From WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life, distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Ira Glass. Our program today in three culture-bridging acts. Act one, the chasm between comedy and music. In that act, two brave people step into that chasm, drop into that chasm, however you put it. Act two, Star of Bethlehem. We bring you the story of the most important, most respected newsman on television in the town of Bethlehem, who does a program that is unlike any news show that you have ever seen. Act three, translating for the very, 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 very tall, in which we have for a change on our program a story that gets us close to someone so famous that you may have actually heard of him if you follow pro basketball in the tiniest way. Stay with us. Act one, the chasm between comedy and music. Well, we start today's program about translation with a story about karaoke. In karaoke, after all, you are the interpreter. You are the translator. You stand there with the words of a song appearing on a little TV monitor, and you try to render a life-size performance, a translation of the original hit, if you will, rendered in the musical language of you. And in a way, it's surprising that the only karaoke we have is for music. Why not karaoke of the I Have a Dream speech or the You Talking to Me from Taxi Driver? Recently, Jonathan Goldstein and Starley Kine, you hear them both on our program from time to time, heard about a karaoke bar which not only had songs, but comedy routines that you could perform on stage. They decided to find out for themselves how stand-up comedy translates to the karaoke stage.
Starley and I talk quite a bit about chops, comedic chops, pacing, placement of the zinger, when to employ whimsy and when to employ wit, chops. Back when we worked in adjoining cubicles, we'd kill time by arguing over what was funny and what wasn't. Blowing cigar smoke in a baby's face, not funny. A baby smoking a cigar, funny. We were like borscht belt comedians without the borscht, the belt, or the audience. But the fact that we weren't knocking them dead at Grossinger's every night didn't keep us from coming up with titles for our showbiz bios. Starley's book was going to be called The Woman Behind the Chops, while I intended to call mine Sir Chops-a-Lot. Why, just the other day I was giving young Starley a quiz. What's the most important thing in comedy, I asked her.
I would have to say...
Timing.
Chops. So finally, Starley and I, after years of talking about comedy, actually decided to go out and create comedy. We were going to take it to the stage and tell jokes for an audience at this karaoke bar. We were going to exchange the tweed vestments of the armchair humorologist for the rainbow-striped suspenders of the practitioner. We wanted to see if we had what it took. The karaoke bar is called the Hidden Cove, and it had catalogs of different comedy routines, all from the late 80s, early 90s. Starley had already looked through them. She decided she was going to do a men-bashing routine called Men Are Perfect, Jerks. We talked about the proper delivery.
Men are perfect, jerks. How's that?
Too deadpan. Like, imagine yourself walking away from the mic and then coming back to the mic. Turning your head and saying into the microphone, jerks.
Okay. Men are perfect. Jerks.
That's not bad. I'd give it maybe a little bit more pause.
The difference in our comedic approach is vast, as is our approach to life. At the office where Starley and I used to work together, people whose names she didn't even know would seek her out, bringing her homemade bread, presenting her with souvenirs from their vacations, and even setting aside her favorite caramel taffies from the communal office candy dish. I, on the other hand, had made the effort to learn the names of their children, grandchildren, and in one case, their pet hamster, Mr. Jinglepot. For all of this, I got nothing. Starley had concerns about the caliber of the jokes on the karaoke machine at the bar, how stale they might be. I explained to her that the material, no matter how cliched or boorish, did not matter. A true humorist, I said, could stand on stage and get laughs while reading an eviction notice. It was all in the delivery. It was all about chops. When we showed up, we learned that the Hidden Cove is a very popular and beloved karaoke bar, and it was filled with patrons who came there every week to sing. This was the first week of the Iraq War, and the regulars, just like everyone else, had wanted some diversion, a night away from the news. They took their karaoke very seriously, too. One man was hunched over a tattered notebook that he'd brought from home, in which he had neatly penciled the code numbers of his favorite karaoke songs, row after row of them. As people got on the stage to sing and dance, there was a general feeling of warmth and beery encouragement in the air. Everyone seemed to know everyone else. And when we asked them about the comedy routines on the karaoke machine, no one could recall ever having seen them done. Even the owners of the bar weren't quite sure what we were talking about. We finally found a lone page of comedy karaoke material, and we signed up to go on. I was after a woman singing a karaoke classic. One of these days, these books are gonna walk all over you. My routine was called My Parents Hated Me. My strategy was to deadpan my way through, following each punchline with my patented hapless look.
I tell ya, I had one hell of a childhood. I'm not saying my parents didn't love me, but my bath toys were a radio and a toaster.
Nothing. Complete, joyless silence. Some things just don't translate to the karaoke stage. A karaoke machine, for instance, has no instinct for comedic timing. It just keeps scrolling down at the same pace. This means that sometimes you have to wait for a punchline to a joke for several awkward moments after having delivered the setup. It was messing up my chops.
When I got lost, the cop helped me to look for my parents. Do you think we'll ever find them? I cried. The cop said, I don't know. There are so many places they could hide.
As I walked off the stage, no one in the audience would meet my gaze. Still, given the circumstances, I didn't think I had done that bad. Next up was Star Lee.
Hey, how about a little mail bashing?
Star Lee pulls out all these moves. She shrugs her shoulders as if to say, what can you do? She breaks free of the staccato rhythms of the karaoke screen and makes the material her own. She even does this thing where she points her toes inward to make herself look littler, and thus cuter. She was like a pigeon-toed puppy taking its very first steps.
Where's the best place to hide money from a man? Your forehead?
She was winning over the crowd and getting laughs. My laughs. They took to her in the same way people in the office did.
Thank you.
I decided to head back up on stage. I was warmed up and the audience was a little more familiar with my work. Plus, I chose a better routine this time. Earlier, I had self-deprecated myself out of laughs. Now, armed with a new selection of material from the karaoke machine, celebrity bashing jokes from 1992, I was gonna kill.
I hear Cher named her daughter Chastity, in memory of her preschool years.
Not only were these jokes old and dated, but they were also tasteless and offensive.
Did you hear about Roseanne Arnold?
Still, I soldiered on, unaware that the grandest failure of timing in the history of comedy was about to unfold. Before I play you this next bit of tape, I should say in my own defense that a karaoke screen holds a weird hypnotic power. You can't help reading whatever rolls down the screen, and you only figure out the meaning of the words you speak as they are tumbling out of your mouth, and then it's too late. I'm going to play you the tape now. Please remember, it's not my fault. Don't judge me.
What's the difference between Ted Kennedy and the Iraqi army? Ted Kennedy has at least one confirmed kill. I don't write this stuff.
Let me just reiterate. This was during the first week of the Iraq War, and things were not going as easily as America had hoped. American soldiers were dying, and there was no end in sight. A few days earlier, or a few days later, and my words would not have stung in the same way. It was not even clear what the audience was booing. It was like they just didn't know what else to do. Perhaps they were booing the sheer, extraordinary coincidence of it all. Here was this leftover joke from the first Gulf War, being told for the first time in over a decade, and being told the very week we had gone back to war with the same country. It was like I had just delivered a punchline after a 10-year pause. Stupidly, I still somehow believed I could redeem myself. Instead, what rolled down the screen next was the second most tasteless joke from 1992.
What's Mike Tyson's definition of foreplay? Jesus, that's...
At this point, the owner actually turned off my mic.
Thank you.
I've always held the greatest gift an entertainer can receive to be laughter that turns into applause. You know, that moment where a wave of laughter climaxes then breaks apart into the kind of appreciative clapping that says to a performer, "We can no longer laugh because our sides are hurting with a pain that is too great. So now we will switch to clapping. God bless you, funny wise man." Now, instead of laughter turning into applause, I was experiencing boos turning into applause as I slunk off the stage.
There wasn't an aspect of that applause that was sort of, that they were kind of with me, that they were sort of, hey, you're all right. Like, we both just went through a bad situation. And
are you kidding?
A little, I mean, because I have to admit that a little bit, I kind of felt like they were sort of sympathetic applause a little bit.
Oh, you're crazy. You're so crazy, I can't believe it. You're in total denial.
No, I just wanted to run that by you, because I thought maybe that was possible.
No, trust me. They were against you.
So I think what this whole experience has taught us is that certain things just don't translate.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, karaoke is best served for music. I think that's the lesson that we've both learned from this experience, that it's better to stick to you know, songs and music like These Boots Are Made for Walking and leave comedy off the karaoke stage.
I would have to say I disagree.
Oh, do you?
Comedy translated just fine when I went up. Since karaoke night, I was so pumped up from my success.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that I thought of some new titles for my book. You want to hear them?
Sure.
Okay. My Chops, My Life. Chopzilla, the chop that was heard around the world. Queen Choptifa.
Is this your idea of a victory lap?
I'm funnier than Jonathan.
That's nice.
The kid stays in the chops. A chip off the old chopping block. Lil Chop. It's lonely near the chop. They call me Choppy. Campanero, a light near the chops.
Jonathan Goldstein with Starley Kine. Or is that the other way around?
Laughing and a clowning just to keep from crying. I'm laughing and a clowning just to keep from crying.
Back to Star of Bethlehem. Okay, now these possibly helpful geopolitical facts. Most Palestinians don't speak Hebrew. Most Israelis don't speak Arabic. Where Palestinians live, in a place like Bethlehem on the West Bank, Israeli newspapers aren't even for sale. Checkpoints block the passage of civilians from one side to another. All of this to say, each side has very little daily knowledge of what the other side is thinking and talking about. But, for the last 2.5 years, since the beginning of the current Intifada, a Palestinian journalist in Bethlehem has had a nightly news program on Bethlehem TV, where he translates the Israeli nightly news broadcast into Arabic, live, in real time. He also translates and summarizes articles from the Israeli newspapers and internet sites. So it's popular in Bethlehem, but it is very complicated, speaking your enemy's language. Nancy Updike tells the story.
Because he's translating, Nasser Laham is reporting things that have never been reported in the territories before. Things that in the normal course of events are not even talked about in public. when Yasser Arafat slapped the former head of security for the West Bank, stuck a gun in his face, and said, "I'm going to kill you." Nasser's translation of an Israeli TV report was the only Arabic language broadcast to mention the incident. When an Israeli newspaper published an exposé about corruption in the top leadership in Bethlehem, Nasser was the only one who picked the story up, and he broadcast his translation in spite of a flurry of increasingly threatening phone calls from the leaders involved. Soon after, they were all ousted. And even though the story came from a newspaper in Jerusalem, which is only 15 minutes away from Bethlehem, most likely no one would have heard about it if Nasser hadn't told the story.
There is no comparing between the Palestinian newspapers and the Israeli newspaper, because our newspapers are very bad. It's hard. It's hard to take the truth from your enemy, from the Israeli side, not from the Palestinian leadership.
All Palestinian media, newspapers, radio, television, except for private television stations like Bethlehem TV, are tightly controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Take the way the Palestinian papers covered the recent power struggle between Arafat and the new prime minister, known as Abu Mazen, whose appointment was supposed to be the first step toward a new peace process.
In the period of Abu Mazen government, they didn't write anything about Abu Mazen. They start to search for Saddam Hussein and the SARS.
So they were writing about the SARS virus rather than Abu Mazen?
Of course, yeah.
Why weren't they writing about Abu Mazen?
You know, Nancy, I keep the newspapers in my house for the history. To say it in 20, 21, 22 April, when all the newspapers in the world, they wrote about Abu Mazen. The Palestinian newspaper, they didn't do that.
Whenever there's a suicide bombing of any size in Israel, Israeli TV goes into non-stop crisis coverage, and Bethlehem TV carries this live, with Nasser translating, for hours. You see emergency workers running stretchers with burned and bloody people to ambulances. I watched with a translator of my own. You'll hear Nasser's voice in Arabic, then my translator in English.
Have you been in the cafeteria? Yes. We were sitting. I heard the explosion. She's talking while she's shivering.
Nasser interjects these kind of details when he's translating. She's shivering as she's talking, because he wants his viewers to know exactly what's happening. They can't hear her voice shaking, so he tells them.
If the Israeli knows what's happening in the Palestinian lands with details, and the Palestinian knows what's happening in the Israeli cities with details, trust me, the decisions will be different.
Do you think that that watching the coverage of a suicide bombing, do you think it makes people, makes Palestinians watching it, do you think it makes them more sympathetic to Israelis?
No, Nancy, I think that the question is wrong. Your question is wrong. Why? Because they saw before. Pictures they saw. Anyone can open the Israeli television and saw the pictures. But they didn't understand what they are talking in the television with the Hebrew. This is my role, to translate emotions, facts, numbers.
In fact, plenty of the details Nasser translates have got to stir outrage rather than sympathy. Nasser's producer told me that one of the reasons Bethlehem TV decided it was important to follow Israel's continuous coverage after a suicide attack is that Israelis speak then without filters. Politicians openly call for what's known as transfer, the removal of all Palestinians from the territories. Ordinary Israelis call for revenge, say the peace process is hopeless because Palestinians are all terrorists. Nasser translates it all without hedging. Palestinians never use the words terrorist or suicide bomber. They say shaheed, martyr. But when Israel TV says terrorist, Nasser does too. I'd wanted to meet Nasser ever since I saw this book he published about Arafat, which is so strange and provocative that it's not in any Palestinian political category so much as orbiting all of them. The cover of the book is red, with a picture of Arafat smiling, and the title is The Truth, The Whole Truth About Yasser Arafat, the man who's led Fatah and the PLO for 37 years. On the back it says, In this book, I put between the hands of the reader what has never been said before about the man who led one of the greatest and longest liberation movements in the world. With all modesty, I present the reader with information in opposition to what Palestinian, Arabic, Islamic, Western, and Israeli research and study have determined about this man. When you open the book, it's empty. All the pages are blank, except the very first page, where Nasser invites the readers to fill the book with their own opinions. "I'm confident that you will have something to write," he says, "because every person views President Arafat as he wishes." Half the Palestinians I show the book to get really angry. The other half burst out laughing, at least in part due to shock. You just don't see this kind of joke, an absurdist prank, in the territories, where the situation is so dire, where everyone feels like the entire world is against them and their leader. In general, Nasser's sense of humor is pretty dark. One time he was telling me how much the Arab world hates Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. He offered this prescription for fighting al-Qaeda and achieving world peace.
If Sharon support the al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden, maybe all the Middle East will be against al-Qaeda. It's a good idea. Try that.
Nasser drives to work in the morning in his beat-up 84 Opel hatchback, a car so crappy it's like a giant neon sign saying, "I am not on the take." He turns on the TV and Israeli army radio and starts looking at the breaking news in Israel over the internet. He lights a cigarette. He smokes all the time, and in this way that makes you feel like everyone else who smokes is just messing around. With every drag, he takes all the smoke in a big gulp. He smokes each one down until the filter's about to melt. I've never seen him eat. Nasser taught himself Hebrew in prison from an Arabic-Hebrew dictionary he asked his parents to send him. I should mention that so many Palestinian men have been to prison that it's almost a given, especially men around Nasser's age, 36, who were young activists at university during the first Intifada. As soon as he learned Hebrew, he started teaching other prisoners. He's taught it ever since, to friends, relatives, students, businessmen. It's sort of a compulsion. His crusade to teach and translate Hebrew raises a question. What good is it, in a violent conflict that's been going on for decades, to speak your enemy's language? What can it change? Nasser reads and enjoys Israeli novels. He listens to Israeli pop, has Israeli friends, mostly journalists. He's an idealist. He believes that learning the language of the other side can be the first step toward understanding them, toward peace. A 28-year-old named Mohammed with a big, sad face, a guy Nasser taught Hebrew to, tells me this story about being in an Israeli hospital in a room full of Israeli kids when he was 16. Mohammed asked the kid in the bed next to him, in Hebrew, "So what are you in for?" "Car accident," the kid said. "And you?" Mohammed said, "I was shot in the leg by an Israeli soldier."
And they asked me why they shot you. Are you one of the terrorists? Are you Hamas? Are you Jihad? And I said, no, I'm not Hamas. I'm not Jihad. I'm a student. I was a student. I go to my school. It was no war. It was nothing. Yani, 6 in the morning, there was no clashes, no throwing stone, nothing. Yani, he was, oh, yeah, I feel like sorry. We are sorry. I'm sorry. They said, I told him that you don't have to say sorry because you are not the one who shot me. And he was just, yani, surprised. And they said, yani, his mother, because she can every day to come to the hospital. My mother, she can't because there's a checkpoint. But his mother, she can come every day. And she was bringing food to me also. Chocolate, food, shaving machine.
She brought you a razor?
Yeah. She give me her phone number. If you need anything, just call. We are here. They ask me a lot of time to come to visit. And I hope when I can.
Not everyone Nasser taught Hebrew to is so hopeful about it. Nasser taught this guy in prison. He says speaking Hebrew helps if you want to have a personal conversation with an Israeli, get to know their life. But when it comes to politics, knowing the language doesn't make any difference at all. The same walls are there, just more clearly. Still, if your only two choices are violence or talking, Nasser chooses talking. He and Muhammad are part of a group of people who do training for community leaders in nonviolence and what they call compassionate listening, how to listen to someone you really, really disagree with. Nasser is against suicide bombings, feels that the Palestinian people have a right to resist, but that the armed resistance is not working at all. Given all this, given his politics, I was surprised by some of the things I saw on Bethlehem TV. One day there were hours of songs celebrating martyrs to the Palestinian cause, including suicide bombers. Another time I saw an unforgettably baroque video celebrating Saddam Hussein. Picture a plump man in a long blue tunic, smiling, singing, and pumping a machine gun up and down in time to the music. Behind him, a crowd of men in uniform is moving their guns and dancing in time also. They're holding a large picture of Saddam Hussein in front of them. Then Saddam himself appears on screen, in a fedora, firing a pistol in the air and smiling. Then the Iraqi army is jogging, followed by anti-aircraft guns shooting, and soldiers marching, and tanks moving against the sunset, and mosques, and more of Saddam in the fedora. This was April. The war in Iraq was long over. When I ask Nasser about it, he tells me not everything on the program reflects his own political views. People call and request these videos all the time, so he plays them. But then he also broadcasts stuff they don't request.
Look, Nancy, yesterday I translated all the speech about the Holocaust. And the people asking me, why? They are our enemy. I said, we have to know also they are suffering. We have to know a lot about the Holocaust. They surprised, but I know that they trust me because I was in the Israeli prison 6 years, because I am living in the Dehesha camp, refugees camp, because I am Muslim, because I am poor, not rich. They trust me. They said, okay, if you say that, we will know a lot about the Holocaust.
By the time he was done, Nasser translated several days of Israel's annual commemoration of the Holocaust. Rest assured, this doesn't happen on any other Arabic language station. I spent a day interviewing people around Bethlehem about what they think of the show.
It's
excellent. He's a good journalist.
It's
fantastic. It's excellent. It's very good. Because they give us the opinion of the people who are in Israel.
Almost everyone I talk to watches the program and loves it. People say they do get information there that they can't get anywhere else. One man told me that when the Second Intifada started, the only way you could find out which Palestinians were wanted by the Israelis and why was by watching Nasser's translation of Israeli TV.
Did you ever learn something new about Israelis that you never knew before?
Yeah.
Like what?
مثلا في مثلا كتاب اسرائيليين بيكونوا بجانب قضيتنا
there are some writers or journalists that are on our side of the Palestinian problem
بيكونوا معارضين لحكومتهم وإشي هيك
against their government
حلو الواحد يكون له مؤيد من الطرف الثاني
it's good to know that there are Israelis who are with us
I saw a very poor Israeli family in the program of Nasser You know, they are very bad economically, more than us. They have maybe bread to eat. This was a new thing for us.
Bethlehem, where the TV station is a dusty, broken down, depressing place. Most businesses are dead or on the ropes. No parks, no pools. In the summer, people often have running water only once a week, or even every 2 weeks. Israeli army vehicles roll through practically every day, sometimes to demolish a house. And the neighbors pull chairs onto their roofs and sit watching the destruction, since most don't have jobs. There are 12 Israeli settlements within 10 miles of Bethlehem, and they're growing. Nasser told me that when he was at work one day, he looked up at the television and saw his own kids, his 11-year-old twins, on TV throwing stones at Israeli tanks and soldiers. He was alarmed. Kids have been shot and killed throwing stones. He talked to them about it that night. "Why are you throwing stones?" he said. "Because they're the enemy," they told him. "Who told you that?" he asked. The kids at school, they said. I asked him if he told them to stop throwing stones, and he said, of course. 3, 4, 5 times, he told them. And then they started lying and saying they hadn't thrown stones when he knew they had. He doesn't know what to do. When he talks to friends, Israeli journalists, on the phone at home, his 11-year-old daughter, Beirut, says, I heard you talking Hebrew. Don't talk to those people. Nasser has been trying to teach his kids Hebrew, so I interviewed the four of them. None of the kids see learning Hebrew as a bridge to peace, the way their dad does. For them, it's way more utilitarian. It helps you talk to soldiers, they say. Maybe it can get you out of a bad situation.
What words and phrases do you know in Hebrew?
No? في كلمات بتعرفوها بالعبراني؟
ايش؟
مثلا جندي حيال ولد يلد
بوكر توف
بوكر توف
يعني صباح الخير
نحن طباب كتان
بكشاو بسيدة
ميم تمتام يعني غبي
خيال in Hebrew which is in Arabic جندي which is soldier kid is ولد يلد بوكر توف good morning please which is بكشاو بسيدر okay بو هنا come here متمتام dumb and the baby tank
why do they know the word for dumb
تسمع مثلا جنود بيحكوا للناس هاي الكلمه متمتام ولا من وين يعني انتم سمعتوها
Beirut's twin brother Marcel a tiny boy with a large retainer in his mouth jumps in
برضه من الجيش بيسبوا على الاولاد
الجيش بيسبوا على الاولاد
برضه الاولاد بيسبوا على الجيش
The soldiers are saying this to the kids, and the kids are saying this to the soldiers.
When I talked to your kids yesterday, they definitely said that the reason that they wanted to know Hebrew was to know the language of the enemy. Does it worry you that your kids aren't getting to meet Israelis at all and that for them it is the language of the enemy?
Of course I'm worried. I'm very worried. I'm worried also because they are throwing stones against the Israeli tanks. I'm worried. I don't want them to do that. You can imagine you are sitting in your office writing and worry about them. What if soldiers shoot at them? What can I say? What can I do? How can I live? What can I say to the others if one of them has been killed? They know just the tanks, the soldiers who are shooting. Why they are not in the same schools? Why they are not in the same pools to swim? My kids don't know the Israeli people. They don't know the kids in Israel. Someone to stop that.
He takes a drag of his cigarette and smiles.
Maybe you can. Try.
Nasser speaks Hebrew and he's teaching his kids, but actual Israelis are a world away, and he can't convince his own children, a genuine captive audience, not to hate them.
Nancy Updike in Jerusalem. Coming up, start a show in a karaoke bar, end a show in a karaoke bar, no matter how little it has to do with the last story and the last act. Can we do it? Dare we do it? Answers in a minute from Chicago Public Radio and Public Radio International when our program continues. This American Life, Myra Glass. Each week on our program, of course, we choose some theme, bring you a variety of different kinds of stories on that theme. Today's program, Lost in Translation. We've arrived at Act 3 of our show. Act 3, translating for the very, 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 very tall. Well, friends, we've heard about the struggles between Palestinians and Israelis, between Russians and Americans. In this act, we ask the age-old question, can there ever be peace between the tall and the short? Can people of different heights ever hope to get along? Jesse Hardman tackled the issue.
My earliest memory of my cousin Colin is fighting with him over a Fernando Valenzuela baseball card. We were both 7 years old, both way into sports, and pretty competitive. Mainly we'd play basketball. If you ask me, I'm a little bit better than he is. Don't ask him. After graduating from college, Colin headed straight to Taiwan and stayed there for almost 3 years, just knocking around, trying to figure out what he wanted to do with his life. He took classes, worked a few jobs. He also played a lot of basketball with locals at nearby gyms. This left him with a very specialized but seemingly unmarketable vocabulary.
Slam dunk.
Hold on. Ball-away jumper. Ho-yang, kao-to.
Weak side defense.
In Chinese, I just say the side without the ball.
When I caught up with Colin 2 summers ago, he was working for the U.S. government in a dead-end job translating Chinese documents. He was determined to start being practical. The words law school forced their way out of his mouth. You could tell he was hitting the career default button. Then an old friend stepped in.
And she had this piece of paper, a job description. NBA player seeks full-time interpreter, looking for native English speaker, fluent in Mandarin Chinese, interest in basketball. So it was like, yeah, right.
2 weeks later, my cousin had made the jump from owning baseball cards to working for one. Sort of.
Now, Fox 26 Sports with Keith Gulkins.
Hi again. Yao Ming in Houston for what, 24 hours or so? The hoopla includes plenty of wide eyes and lots of curiosity seekers, as if they've never seen a 7'6 Chinese millionaire before.
It turns out that Colin's new job wasn't with some benchwarming experiment. Yao Ming is the starting center for the Houston Rockets. And if you haven't heard of him, congratulations. You officially know nothing about sports in America. He's the biggest story out of the NBA this year. The first foreigner ever to go number one in the NBA draft. His style of play is supposed to revolutionize the game, the same way that Michael Jordan's did. Add to this, he has the hopes and dreams of a billion emerging NBA fans in Asia riding on his shoulders. And Colin met him for the first time, the same day the rest of America did.
He's coming in. Yao Ming.
You know, at the airport, at first there weren't that many people, and all of a sudden you get the whole lobby is just crowded, and the people are surrounding him. And, you know, I had to get up and translate right away. He had to give a few brief statements to the crowd, and we had never met.
Speaking through interpreter Colin Pine, Ming says he's anxious to get on the court and work on his game with his new teammates.
After waiting such a long time, it's like opening a door and having a breath of fresh air.
I think my heart was about to burst through my chest. And I'm up there with the lights on me, next, you know, Yao Ming sitting next to me, and then I've heard of instances of people who had to do translation in situations like that just choking, just not being able to say anything. I'm floating above the ceiling, looking back at myself doing this, and just for me to get through that first time, I was pretty happy.
Fans, it's time to stand up, make some noise, and get ready to meet your Minnesota Timberwolves!
Early in the season, I catch up with Colin at a game in Minnesota. My first chance to see his new life from the inside.
Yeah, you're right here.
We stand in a nondescript concrete hallway near the visiting locker room. Players are walking by, ribbing Colin and smacking him on the ass. Superstars like Glenn Rice and Steve Francis. Colin's idol since college. Guys I'm used to seeing on TV.
Mr. Glenn Rice.
Colin disappears into the Rockets locker room. A few minutes later, he reappears with his new boss, Yao Ming. Yao's 7'5". Colin's my height, 5'9 in shoes. Yao slouches up against the locker room wall. Colin leans in next to him. A crush of TV cameras, microphones, and notepads descend on the pair. Lots of the reporters are from Asia.
Thank you.
Yummy.
Hold up. Wait. Excuse me.
Hey, wait. Excuse me, let me translate, please. Thank you.
It's a month into the season, and media fascination with Yao's story is bigger than anyone imagined. Yao's the only player who reporters want to talk to before and after every game, regardless of how he plays. The questions tend to be the same in every city. Questions about adapting to the NBA and life in America. What do you do in your spare time? He sampled the local cuisine. And, of course,
does he see himself as a role model to other Asians in America?
For the most part, Yao feeds them straight sports cliche. One day at a time, I'm still learning the game. But every once in a while, he'll give him an answer that leaves reporters scratching their heads. Like this question, where the reporter asks, what's it like to play against Minnesota star Kevin Garnett?
他给我的感觉就像只蜘蛛一样，四肢很长很长。
he seems like a spider.
Spider.
然后呢？
很长很长的手臂，很长很长的腿。
He's strong arms and strong legs. Spider.
蜘蛛的。
Yeah, like a spider.
The bulk of Colin's translating work is just getting Yao through these daily press conferences. Yao speaks enough English to communicate with coaches and players during games and practices, but Colin sits with the team courtside, just in case.
Sit right there, behind the bench in the red seats right there. They don't need me that much, though.
So what do you do most of the game?
Watch and cheer and try not to say too much. I gotta be careful. I'm a very enthusiastic fan, but I need to maintain a professional demeanor, I suppose.
Fast forward 2 hours, fourth quarter. Rockets down by 6 with a few minutes to go.
Oh, come on!
So much for professional demeanor. Colin's up out of his seat, looking like he wants a piece of the ref. But if anything, this actually helps him fit in with the team. Here's backup center Kelvin Cato and backup point guard Muchie Norris.
He get mad when calls go bad like we do. He's a basketball player that can't play. He's sitting on the bench.
He's one of the boys. He's one of the guys now. You know, he works here. He's with us. He's part of the team now. So we love him to death. I'm just happy he's here.
And it's not just the players who glow about Colin. A Rockets executive tells me that most NBA translators are just linguists with no feeling for the game. That Colin's made it way easier for Yao. Even the press loves him. Sam Smith is a veteran basketball beat writer for the Chicago Sun-Times.
I've been around a lot of international events with the Olympics with translators, and he's been absolutely the best and most efficient and effective interpreter I've ever been around. You know, more than most guys in that situation, you could tell Colin not only is close to Yao, but they like each other. They're comfortable with each other, and they trust each other, and that's a situation you never see.
Yeah, we're gonna go to Burger King right now, buddy. Where's his dad? I don't know. Here, talk to Yao Ming. I'm going to Yao Ming.
Here's what most of my cousin's glamorous job looks like up close. Usually, he and Yao are nowhere near a basketball court. Usually, he's not even translating. Right here, Colin is trying to get Yao to the DMV so he can take his driver's test. It's part of Colin's job to be Yao's driving instructor. The problem today is a National Geographic film crew wants to tag along. Colin can't find Yao's dad, who's also taken the test, and Yao's hungry. Colin literally can't go 10 minutes without having his cell phone ring, and it's never for him. Yao's agents, people from the Rockets, from the press, from the companies Yao endorses, even Yao's parents, they all get to him through Colin.
Angie, it's Colin.
Sorry
to I just wanted to find, when is a good time? When am I going to be able to give you this stuff? After the game, or like all the tea, and I have something I need to give you, and I think I have a check from Yao Ming or his mother.
Here's something else. Colin lives with Yao in a huge house in a gated community in a Houston suburb, together with Yao's mother and father, who keep a tight leash on their 22-year-old son. Originally, Colin was supposed to have his own place, but the Yaos invited him into the house early in the season. He thought about it and decided it made sense, since he'd be spending almost every minute with Yao anyway.
And I also felt like, you know, they were being very nice in offering, and I felt like I didn't want to offend them by turning it out. But it made sense. It just made a lot of sense. But I'm 29, and, you know, I'm not accustomed to living with a family. Yeah. Sometimes I think, you know, that his mom looks at me as a little kid, but I know she worries, like, if I don't eat enough or
you know. She's, and it's really sweet. It's nice. But it's a little strange.
It'd be strange to move back in with your own family at 29, let alone a Chinese family you just met, which doesn't speak English, and whose shortest member, Yao's mom, is a half foot taller than you. Colin doesn't like talking about his home life with the Yao's. That's private. So private that he never has anyone over to visit, friends or family. He can't even invite me in for a beer.
No. Okay, now, after this.
2 days after Yao passes his driving test, I tag along with him and Colin as they head home from practice. They sing along to the radio together, they finish each other's sentences, and tease each other in a mixture of English and Chinese.
Before I met him, I think Colin is maybe 40 years old people. When I saw him, I think, oh my God, it's a young boy, maybe younger than me. But I asked him, he said 28. I said, 28? That looks very young.
Does Colin have any annoying traits? Does he not clean up his room or anything? Does he hog the Nintendo?
还是就是一直玩电动玩具不让你玩。
你吵过我吗？应该是我一直不玩的不让你玩吧。
He can't beat me, so I'm the one who's always hugging it.
Their bond has been formed through an intense mutual experience. The world of the NBA is foreign to both of them.
There were lots of times, especially on the road, you know, we'd have dinner in the hotel room, and we'd talk and we'd say, I would get stressed out over a press conference or something, and I'd tell him, you know, this is why I'm stressed, and this is, you know, and he'd do his best to help me after that. And then, you know, it was harder for me to help him because, you know, the pressure on him was so much greater. I mean, for instance, the second Laker game in L.A., we lost in overtime, and he fouled out, and he was really upset. And I said, you know, if you hadn't, he had a great game, though. And I said, you know, if you hadn't played well, we probably wouldn't have gotten here, gone to overtime. The only thing I could do was just, you know, be an ear, be somebody, you know, who said, you know, I understand. And then mean it, because I got to see it firsthand.
Yao Ming, Yao Ming, Yao Ming, Yao Ming, Yao Ming, Yao Ming, Yao Ming.
3/4 of the way through the basketball season, I catch a Rockets game at Madison Square Garden in New York City. It's a packed house, despite the fact the New York team, the Knicks, suck. Almost a third of the crowd is Chinese, many of them attending their first NBA game. They're here because of Yao, who's now a full-fledged phenomenon. He's only been in the U.S. for 4 months, but he's already the new face of Apple Computer, Gatorade, and Visa. To the surprise of the normal Knicks crowd, Yao's army comes ready to scream, and many have made homemade signs proclaiming their love of Yao.
What's your sign say here?
Yao Ming, the next big thing.
What's so exciting about him?
Honestly, I feel very proud. I plan on opening a basketball camp in Pakistan in the future because of this, and I want to, like, open the doors for Pakistanis to get into the game of basketball.
That's right, Pakistan. This is the power of Yao Ming. He's united the Asian mainland with the Indian subcontinent. Just to see how far his celebrity extends, I asked this 22-year-old fan about my cousin.
He's got a translator. What do you think of that job?
Oh, I actually have a sign for him right there.
What does it say?
Right here. Move over, Batman and Robin. We have some new heroes in town, Yao Ming and Colin Pine. Citizens of Houston, have no fear. Ming and Pine are here. I'm just a huge fan. Colin Pine, he's Yao's right-hand man right now. I mean, he's the one that's doing all the talking for Yao in English.
Yeah,
so Yao, we get Yao's word through him.
Is he a celebrity?
Oh, definitely. Anyone around Yao is a celebrity, I'll tell you that much.
I'm floored by this, and my question of the night becomes, who's Colin Pine?
You guys know who Colin Pine is?
The interpreter.
Yao Ming's translator.
We actually ran into Colin Pine in Chinatown in Houston at a Chinese karaoke bar, and yet Colin Pine was singing perfect Mandarin.
One woman knows so much about him that she could have written this story.
He worked at the State Department, and he applied online and didn't think he would get the job and was shocked when they called, and basically he was told he had to be here like yesterday. And he was excited because he was a huge Steve Francis fan.
before, I think he was translating documents for the U.S. government. He must be the luckiest man in the world right now.
That guy's got the best job in the world.
I'd like to have his job.
In my very informal survey, 50% of the crowd knows my cousin by name. One Chinese-American co-ed, who carries a sign saying, "I'm single and bilingual, hey Yao, you and me, let's mingle," tells me, "My cousin's hot." Colin's heard it before.
I've had girls pass me cards. Not often. It's not like the players get it all the time, I'm sure. But consciously and subconsciously, there's part of me that is really wary of that whole part, the whole thing. Just, you know, I want somebody to like me for the witty, intelligent, charming person that I am. My friends are like, "This job is so wasted on you."
Now it's me again.
I only want to be your friend. Talk upon
on a warm spring night, Yao, Colin, and I are out at a Chinese karaoke bar. Yao just passed his driving exam, and he wants to celebrate. He never goes out. This is a really big deal. He's out of the house, and his parents aren't around. The club sits in a stucco Chinese mini mall in a cookie-cutter Houston suburb between a nail salon and a takeout place called the Fancy Noodle. Everyone has a couple of beers, but this is definitely the G-rated version of an NBA night out. Colin loves karaoke. He sings a Chinese love ballad with an English chorus, "I only want to be your friend." Yao, appropriately enough, responds with the Backstreet Boys hit, "Larger Than Life." Yao later tells me this night was the most fun he's had in America.
"5 years from now, you're going to be a veteran in the league. You'll be a superstar, and you'll speak English, and you won't need an interpreter. So who will Colin Pine be to you then, in 5 years? Still friends.
Still friends?
Do you think you'll hang out still?
还是可以出去玩吗?
如果你不介意我把你的女朋友抢掉了。抢掉,
if you don't mind, and you don't mind me stealing your girlfriend, then it's okay.
Jesse Hartman is a reporter at Chicago Public Radio. Our program was produced today by Alex Bloomberg and myself, with Diane Cook, Wendy Doran, Starley Kine. Our senior producer, Julie Snyder. Elizabeth Meister runs our website. Production help from Todd Bachman and Katie Adan. Special thanks today to Kent Rahill, Jeff Weltman, and Tommy Shepard. Music help from Consigliere Sarah Val. Nancy Updike's story was part of the Hearing Voices Project, which is funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and is online at hearingvoices.com. Our website, www.thisamericanlife.org. This American Life is distributed by Public Radio International, WBEZ, management oversight by Tori Malatia, who calls me up drunk at least one night a week and says,
"Hey, how about a little mail bashing?"
I'm Ira Glass, back next week with more stories of This American Life.
PRI, Public Radio International.